have the presenters up here if you want. There's a big enough audience to use for them. Questions or comments? Clarifications?
My question is for Anna. We, I thought, was one of the most frequently used words in your talk.
Mm-hmm.
And as a grammatically, politically organized and function, I think it's interesting and dangerous.
It's nice.
And yeah, I'm sure. So I want to engage with it. I want to refuse it.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to ask you, since you end with the conception, a very clear notion of agency,
okay,
how it is that you would theorize your capacity to engage in some agentive way in relation to these machines?
Me personally?
Sure, why not?
Well, I designed them.
Uh-huh.
So, that's where I intervene. I also use them.
Mm-hmm.
I intervene on that level as well. The reason I use we is to implicate us.
Mm-hmm. But you also laid out what I would regard as a political project.
Mm-hmm.
That somehow we have the capacity to interfere, to intervene in terms of the design of these machines.
We do.
So I would like to know how it is that you would theorize our capacity, or at least your capacity, now I'm even implicating myself, your capacity to intervene.
Hmm.
Theoretically, how would you make that work?
That's an excellent question. I'm not sure I can give a really quick sort of easy answer to it either. I'm not entirely sure. Can you push me in a direction? Because I think you want me to go somewhere, and can you push me towards where you want me to go? And I'll see
ethically,
if I can do something with that.
Ethically, I think if you're going to implicate us, or
yeah,
at least me,
mm-hmm,
as having this agentive relationship with these machines,
yeah,
then you have to at least have a theoretical articulation that would link us to these machines in such a way that we would have this kind of agency.
Well, that's the multiplicity, I suppose. You can't get out of it, really. The linking isn't something that, it's not a choice. You're already there.
Where?
Oh, the space of transduction.
Oh. Okay.
Take a question at the back and just build on that.
Yeah. Thanks to the presenters. Excellent papers. Very inspirational. My question is for Anna. You were describing what I thought was a really fantastic and creative vision of the city, right? I wrote down the annotated city, what a great idea, saturated with data. Okay, so then now, I guess maybe I'm thinking towards the Congress at York next year or something, but what kind of citizenry is then produced? Can you just expand your thoughts and say more smart things for us about citizens, the data citizens, or whoever are producing the city?
Right. Well, I can give you examples of how people are working with these technologies. Maybe that'll help. One of my case studies is a project called Urban Tapestries, and they're using smartphones to allow you to both enter and retrieve data on a particular map point. So what you're getting is sort of the collective narrative and history of the city, and you can sort of unravel those threads. So they're talking about being able to produce meaning and content ground up. They have, these people that are working in locative media are really, really politically oriented. They despise the machinery of, say, GPS, which is, the height of military technology, sort of. And they say, okay, well, what can we do with this? How can we engage as a citizen to create our own sense of space? It's also relevant, too, that Urban Tapestries is working in the UK, where the Ordnance Survey has a very different relationship with mapping than, say, we do in Canada. So it's not, you cannot work with Ordnance Survey maps. So they want to see, how can a citizen map the world? And how they're trying to get at it is by allowing or encouraging people to create maps according to personal and collective memory and expression. Did that get it?
That's very cool. Urban tapestry?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yes. Can I also say I've gone through really wonderful and inspiring and, you know, complex and really wonderful ways on papers. First, just like a quick point, it's interesting, I think, to follow this session on to the session at 9 o'clock yesterday morning on the animal. Because I think the question of the recalcitrance of the animal and the way the animal sort of disrupts conventional ways of thought and symbolic and so on fits really nicely, you know, with what you were all saying in different ways. You're also working around that question, perhaps, but to sort of put more of a focus on that, can we talk, say, is it Yarn or Jan?
It's Yarn.
Yarn, okay. Great paper. If I can push a bit more on the psychoanalytic aspect of it, we're talking about the Lacanian real and the unconscious as well, and the self-reflexivity with the capital X. And I'm wondering, is the event you're talking about in Elephant, is it more like the real? Is it more like something that's recalcitrant, something that the symbolic stumbles over in the plain terms? Or is it more like the, you know, the object petitart? Is it a problem for our interpretation, or the sort of the nodal point, the neighborhood interpretation? Or is it a Brennian knot? Is it where the imaginary and the symbolic and the real sort of come together? Because it could be all of those things, perhaps. But you're using the language of psychoanalysis quite sort of intimately, and so I'm wondering if you would come down anywhere more particularly on that question.
It's a tough question for me, because I find that when I go to philosophical circles, it seems there's quite a divide between Deleuzians and Lacanians, you know, that you're either pitted as a Deleuzian or you're pitted as a Lacanian. And I think this piece that I did was kind of my venturing out, trying to kind of get a feel for Deleuze, you know, through film. And my own sense is that I find much more transpositional overlap between the two thinkers than I do kind of this either-or kind of, you know, setting up grounds. And for example, you know, when you have Deleuze talking about immanent life, I find this very easy to sort of think this as a life as, you know, the singularity of a life. Much like Lacan would say, there's something in you more than yourself, you know, and that singularity, in a sense, is identified by what I would call a life as solely, you know, Z-O-E, something that is completely different from life as bios, you know, which of course, Foucault talks about that. So bios, in a certain sense, the way life, in a certain sense, is already packaged, if you like, by the state, already, you know, signifiers dropped on it, so to speak. You know, the bee orchid thing has that sensibility of Zoe, you know, something that is yet, you know, impossible to pin, you know, pin down. I get nervous sometimes with Deleuze because of the, it seems to lead to me to, you know, kind of a heightened complexity theory, which worries me at times. And I often wonder how much of that is overlaid with kind of a biologism that is residual in Deleuze that worries me. But I have not much difficulty, again, in terms of trying to understand this sort of virtual, the virtual subject and the virtual notion of the past and the virtual notion of the present as somehow kind of expanding on Lacan's notion of the real, you know. And that's why I like to use, to think of it as an X, because I think we can move from self-reflection, you know, the naive notion of self-reflection to, you know, self-reflection with an X, you know, with a small X, this kind of thing that has gripped really a society that is caught by information, you know. We're supposed to decide on our own, like the neoliberalist sort of subject too, an X, you know, to the question mark of the psychosis that the two boys experienced. And from a Lacanian position, you know, this is a call to the symbolic, you know, that to commit this hideous act, right, is to be able to sort of be subjectivized. That was the sort of the conclusion that I was trying to claim. That's a subjectivization to authority that didn't exist from them, you know, because authority, as many have argued, has been vacated to today, right? The authority has been vacated, and the performative no has, you know, been pretty well left with you with information, kind of laughingly, you know, like, you know, don't watch this film, you know, here's the warning, you know, these, you know, it's all up to you, sort of thing. So, what I found kind of interesting with this film is that it seemed to blend so well, for me, in my own understanding of it, so well, with this kind of odd a-subjectivity that fits the Lacanian real. An a-subjectivity where, you know, as I was trying to argue, that it doesn't totalize things, but puts you in kind of this notion of, in a kind of an odd ethical position, because it disrupts, you know, all the kind of common sense arguments that were made why the psychosis occurred, you know, the playing, you know, video games, and you know, the boys themselves were abjected, and so on. It's the best I can do for the
Brian.
Can I just intervene there and ask a question of my own? And just picking up on this sort of emptiness, ironically, of the panopticon, to realize this is virtualization of authority, the flight of power into protocol, rather than a sovereign position. And Ulu, do you want to comment on this? Because I wonder to what extent the bee and the orchid is an attempt to answer the question of where did power go, where, what happens to individualization, what happens to agency, and the capacity for action. Can you say something about that?
That's a very tough one.
Yes. What does this particular experience allow us to see? I'm going to be very, I'm going to try, okay? To give you a very close example. Think of Katrina. And this is not ideal, right? You can say 911, the people of us were in here, right? Think of Katrina, or think of 911, or think of. Well, these are all things that we know about, or we knew about, right? We know about everything that has been booked. Everything pre-911, right? In relationship to the West, and we knew about, we knew that, I have the longer version of it, I'm talking about, I'm giving the example of Katrina. We know that, for example, let me give you some figures. In 90, we have some numbers that about 99% of blood in New Orleans are poor. They have not even car. They have 65% cannot run away from you know, they cannot leave. We knew about that. But what is this event? This is what I see. One virtualized event. And when Katrina appears or is become an event of exposition, then we reactivate. I'm trying to find the words here. We reactivate something that was interiorized, something that was interior to us. We reactivate, we expose it by saying that, oh, all these poor black, this is an example for me of the bee and orchids. Moving at the same time, look at this. There is no past, there is no present in this, in Katrina. Everything is there at the same time. But the event actualized what we knew. So for me, it's an example, a very practical example. And I do also believe that cinema, as an object of study, as an object of knowledge, can allow us, because I have all these images, I even have some in my computer, I can actualize this event for you right now. And if, just by talking about it, you have the image, right? Right. But this event, you have the image right now in front of you. But these events are temporarily in the past. this is actuality and virtuality are always there, every time you know, they are crystallized. Basically, they are crystallized. Right.
Yeah, I
mean,
again, congratulations to all of you. The papers were great. My question is, I have a sort of series of little drawings of Padgering that try to turn it into a question. It starts with something that you said about maps. You made reference to
Stuart
Hall's collective map and the mattering maps of Grossberg.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering how useful these C-maps as being in relationship to thinking through the virtual and the actual.
Mm-hmm.
My sense is that maybe I just have a limited understanding of maps, that they have, that they're static, right? That, like, for example, in a political situation, if you look at a map from the 1930s, the way that it represents the Middle East, the way that represents a map today represents it, you know, there's no accounting within the map itself about the transition that takes place. And the thing that strikes me as interesting about the virtual and the actual is that it's a way of accounting for those transitions, the political processes of life, etc., and how those things move back and forth. So I don't know. I'm wondering what you might say about how the map as a metaphor fits into the equation.
I mobilize the concept of the map. This is from actually, you know that certainly that Grossberg was one of the four core students, and actually they changed this concept by matching map or basically what we're talking about is social convention. this is what they're talking about. And the map is not the kind of material map that you draw. The map here is meaning that I was trying to argue on the dialectic part of the question that was posed to us, that we cannot actually talk about the difference without going back to our social convention. And this social convention force or commands us to locate the virtual with the actual. That's the first step. So the second step is that you don't have to see the virtual as within this particular map, because this is what has been done in cultural studies particularly, to see in that kind of some post-colonial theories, to see that in that articulation of virtual and actual as a space of negotiation. I don't think so. I don't think it's a space of negotiation. I don't think the B and the R people are negotiating whatsoever. I think they're having a tension. And this is why the wedding is always a space of struggle, where my own identity and your own identity are coming together to the coalescence. And whatever it is called, coalescence, they're coming together at that point. And that point is a moment of struggle. Right? For me, it's not another kind of moment. It's not a moment of negotiation. It's a moment of struggle. It's a moment between which these two basic different elements and different elements coalesce. I don't know if you use the term in English or not, for coalesce, right? Come together in a shock. This is a shock, and this is what Katrina is a shock for your own memory. This is where you have the shock. And so I believe that you can always, the map here, you can only, this is our own social convention, I can lose understanding because of this.
Other questions?
Yeah, I have a question for Jan, or just wanted to say that I really appreciated linking sort of the discussion of the Bayesian virtuality, which often does really, to me, way up in the air, to the Columbine event through the film Elephant. And I just wondered if maybe you or anybody else on the panel might talk a little bit about how organizing life around sort of dominant sense of time has real violent material effects. So in this, let's say, this recognizing the sort of co-simultaneous presence of Alex and Eric, I think, can actually have these violent material effects in actual world.
I'm not sure how to go about that. I'm thinking, you know, the move I would make in a certain sense, that once you're in the symbolic order, no matter how it works, you're always organized by time, chronological time. A friend of mine, Paul, uses the term padual, sort of like the whole notion of patterns and schedules that we all, in an anthropological sense, are organized by. And of course, you know, depending on how the organization operates, you're going to have better or worse, and I'm not saying good or bad, just, you know, worse or worser, if you like, writings of the body, which many of us already, you know, try to grapple with how these discourses write us in time. But what I find so interesting about Elephant was that it sort of shows that in a way, as teachers, and you know, I am a teacher, I feel I'm a teacher, we don't know these students, you know, that these long tracking shots of just their backs, just their heads, that, and catching conversations, and you know, shows you that, you know, you don't know them. And in a certain way, there's this disconnect that's always presented throughout the film, that you know, the kids themselves don't know each other, if you will. And rather than you having this kind of usual Hollywood flick, you know, where it's cliques in the schools, it's presented as a very decentering kind of place, that there is a, you know, a strange alienation that is continually at work.
Do you want to comment on that?
No. I don't want to go there.
Next question.
Yeah, good. I'm wondering, in a way, what brings your paper and this collaboration with the other two presenters is perhaps the notion of these microfilms, these micro movies that people now are making on mobile phones and so on. And I'm wondering, is there any connection between, you know, what you were saying and that sort of practice as well? In, you know, in terms of the way in which we negotiate our that sort of relationship to virtual space and computer space and so on.
I'm not quite sure I understand your question.
Well, it's I suppose it another way of putting it would be to say that it really defines our relationship, you know, to cinema. I mean, obviously we watch cinema now, you know, in our homes, as much as we get out to watch it. But you sort of like there's almost the privacy of, you know, people almost, you know, shoot their own mobile phone movies just when they're moving around. And now they're banned, at least in Australia, in change rooms and that sort of thing. There's something going on there about a sense of engagement with media and with representation and with, you know, art and cinema and so on a very, very different scale. You know, maybe something like a private scale. Right. There was a movie on, was it a couple of nights ago, I don't know what, which one it's called, but it's, when someone puts a little like, contact lens in their eye and they can see what the other person is seeing. And so I'm not sure if that was on top of it. Anyway, a lot of channels here, a lot of things on. You know, does that open up a little bit more?
It does actually. It reminds me of, so far, most of the developments have been textual. So this addition of the image, especially with camera phones, is quite different. There have been people working with GPS traces, and they'll actually create a static map of where people move through a city. So you'll get this sense of, for example, the city becomes the movement of her people, but this map isn't moving. Mm-hmm. It isn't intelligible, really, to anybody outside of it. It's not a Deleuzean map with multiple entrances. It isn't. It's almost the exact opposite of the tracking in the first place. So you have that kind of static representation of mapping from the ground up, but it doesn't extend very well. You get people who are able to create narratives, and you can get narrative mappings like that in little movies of text, so to speak. We can work with static images. It's getting better. The technology is a bit limiting now, but if we can shift it into the cinematic realm where we'll be able to, say, stream all of this, and I mean, we're not there yet at all, but it will probably come, and we'll have perhaps a different sense of authorship. The people who are working in these fields right now are very, very excited about redefining the author. Now, in terms of community, I think it becomes very interesting in audience, because we get to a point where I can leave you a message in this annotated city that only you can see. So you and I can have private communication in public space. And this becomes a matter of protocol again. Is this a closed node or an open node? Who will be able to access it? You can have 10 points of data in one spot, but you can't see them all. You can't do anything with it. The networks are often ad hoc and based on who you already know. So you're sharing stories and communicating and building community. It's a closed set already. You're not encountering difference. The social networking models that they're working with that say these are who we come together with, they are assuming that people come together because and only because of shared interests and values. There's no serendipity in these systems. They've built it out. So the kinds of cinema, the kinds of time and wider engagement are different. The scale is different. The context is different.
Yeah. I just have a comment, and maybe it's one that ends my play with. I agree totally with this notion that the panopticon is not the metaphor to use, that the society of control really is the notion of how to keep one out, right? It's possession of the signifier, right? It's possession of the protocol. And so, you know, the question is, you know, you ask on the previous other question that emerged, you say to yourself, well, what kind of agency do you have? You know, like, I mean, the voice there, it's suicidal, right? It becomes, suicidal. And the other side of it is you become a hacker, you know, and it's really interesting to understand, you know, those are the, you know, or a terrorist, right? And so, you know, you're looking at extreme forms of agency in order to break a symbolic order. And so, you know, it raises ethical, difficult questions here.
That just triggered this thing about agency. I have a friend who created a program called Wi-Fi Hog. Now, amongst this locative media community that's really political, they argue constantly for open protocols. They want everything open because then we have greater agency. Okay, that's the assumption. So, and these public networks, they're totally open so that when you go out to the quad, that wireless network is available for you. Jonah stepped in and he, as a good hacker, said, I want to be able to take over a public network. I want to turn this public open network into a closed private network. And everybody went, oh my God, why would you do that? It flies in the face of everything we're trying to do. Well, he brought up a really sort of basic everyday point in that the average person, whoever this, you know, mythical creature is, has a device that they're not particularly aware how it works. So your wireless card is set up to automatically, this is default in operating systems, to automatically connect to the strongest signal. So here we have, say, on the second floor of the TELUS building, a public network that is broadcasting all around the area, and you won't have to pay for it. But Verizon has more money. They put their base station on the ground, and that means that your computer picks up their signal first and wipes out this public network. And if you don't know to go back into your own systems protocols and reset it and to search for other networks, then you won't have access to it anyway. So he wanted to be able to take over that public network, boost the signal, and bump Verizon out.
Another option is suicide.
We
have time for one more question. I'm going to thank our presenters for challenging us, pushing the limits of signification. Thank you very much.
Yeah.